Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Dan.
Hi, I'm Isabel.
And today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about D&D art in the 90s. This is the third volume of our series that we do about once a year here. And I'm so happy that I managed to get some time with Brooklyn-based artist and actor Isabel Garbani, who has appeared at many other times on our channel and not
That's
so much
right.
lately. So Isabel, thank you so much.
You're welcome. This
is one of the more popular show series that we do, actually. So thank you so much for giving us some of your very valuable time today to talk about D&D art in the 90s.
Art in the 90s, back when we were young.
Ish.
No, we were young then. Now we're young-ish.
Ish. So, so you used to appear more frequently on our channel, obviously.
That's true.
I'll remind viewers, Isabel has a Master in Fine Arts from the New York Academy of Art here.
So I'm perfectly qualified to talk about art and art-related subjects.
Very qualified. Some of our patrons from week to week have been asking, why is Isabel... So the number one thing that you would appear on a regular basis was our Book of War Wargaming shows on Saturdays, and we haven't been able to get the schedules right to do that on a regular basis, unfortunately,
right.
which pains me to no end. And our patrons
because
regularly...
Because you were winning all the time.
I was winning slightly more than half the time. Just slightly.
Yeah.
And we're sufficiently competitive that I understand that would hurt. That would hurt me if I was on the receiving end of it.
Yeah.
So our patrons regularly ask what you've been up to. What have you been up to lately?
What have I been? That's a good question.
What's Isabel in 2022 like?
2022, well, you know, ups and downs. There have been some really, great projects and acting and classes and, you know, meeting people and doing background work and things like that. And then some not so great things. good and bad. Lately a little more challenging, I guess. You know, we've had some cancellations of the show that I was in that's been a
right.
little hard to digest.
Right.
But you know, moving on, and had a whole bunch of auditions last week, and doing some self tapes this week. So basically, yeah, that's the life of Isabel these days. Auditions and hoping somebody picks me. Pick me! Pick me!
You know, I mean, in the past couple of months, I mean, you've done a number of indie film projects.
Yep.
I mean, you were in Philadelphia filming a thing a couple of weeks ago.
That's true.
A couple of things showed up on YouTube.
Yep.
Hopefully more of that. Now, and in addition, I think we wanted to mention the tour guiding that you do in New York.
Yes. Yeah, so I stopped teaching during the pandemic. I think a lot of people who were adjuncting, stopped just because there were no jobs and had to do something else. Me is because I realize I don't like teaching.
a potentially reasonable viewpoint.
A friend of mine had mentioned that, I should do tour guiding, and I get my license, my New York City tour guiding license. And I started doing a lot of guided tours at the Met. So, art tours, and, the company I work for gives me a lot of leeway as to the script, so I could do whatever I wanted. And so I thought that could actually be something that I could bring to the table today, is like some of the stuff that I do during those guided tours with, with folks who are not necessarily like artists or, know a lot about art, and feel that they have to go to the Met because it's on the bucket list, and it's like this... the biggest museum in the U.S. So, got to go see that. But they don't know where to start or what they're looking at. And so my job is trying to kind of like make them figure out like why we care about some of the stuff that we look at. And I thought that would be kind of interesting to bring some of that to
cool.
today's show.
Cool.
If that's okay with you.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome we get to hear from your perspective on that.
Yeah.
Now, to be clear, the Met is?
The Metropolitan Museum of Art. So biggest museum in the U.S., you know, very overwhelming. Even for me, you know, to go there is, you know, can be a little overwhelming. There's a lot of stuff that I don't know is even there. You know, they had like, you know, many departments and, you know, spans like thousands of years of, you know, human civilization. So, you know, very comprehensive collection of a lot of art from a lot of different perspectives.
So. I love going to the Met, and the couple times that you and I have gone with friends or family members, they always come away and go, Isabel is an amazing guide. She's so fantastic.
Thank you.
And while we were chatting about that, our friend Ragnar is saying that he saw the short horror film that you were in and thought it was great, which is fantastic. What, remind us what the name of that is.
So that's called The Perfect Daughter, and I play a murderer, and I think I'm being cast for it. That's a lot of crazy. Which I guess, you know, you gotta have a type. So my type is the psychopath. I gotta embrace that. You know?
You do a good aggressive crazy.
I do a good, you know, because in February I actually was also in another in another short film that, you know, is not out yet, where I played a psychopath. I actually kill my daughter at the end of that show. It's like, oh my God, I'm a nice person, I swear. Well, maybe I'm not, I don't know.
It's, you know, it's a release. I, you know, I hear other actors say that it's a good, you know, it's a release, and, you know, and they're very different from the roles that they play.
Yeah, there you go.
Good for them.
There you go. I'm very different in real life.
So before we get into D&D Art of the 90s, let me set a little bit of historical context. So D&D in the 90s, in 1990, they came out with a second edition of the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons game, which is what the main line was called at the time. So they make about a new edition about once every decade. So 1990, they had a second edition come out. And the 90s are primarily known for setting source books. So there was this crazy proliferation, this explosion of different campaign settings. And you'd get a boxed set, and here's D&D in space. Or here's D&D post-apocalyptic, or here's D&D in a hollow world, or here's D&D in a number of different possible settings. And they've never had as many settings come out one after the other as they did in the 90s. Mm. So in theory, Shannon Appleklein, who we've had on the show before, who's a D&D historian, has said that the campaign settings of this period have a strong artistic design. Mm. So at least in theory, every setting ought to have a specific visual appearance that should distinguish it from the other campaign settings. So I guess I'm kind of be interested in whether you see that or not, or whether the overall idiom is not as distinct as I might think it to be, actually. Mm. So that's what I'm going to be looking for here. I'm glad you're on the show, because Ragnar's reminding us, if you are a specialist in horror movies, our D&D games are mostly just horror stories all the time. So it really fits perfectly well. I'm so glad you're here today. So let's look.
I'm not a specialist. I just play one on TV. Horror.
So let's start by looking at Jeff Easley. So we actually talked about Jeff Easley in our prior installment of this, looking at artists of the '80s. So Jeff Easley was probably the prince of number one artist, like in the late '80s to early '90s. So they tasked him with making the covers of the brand new core rule books for D&D. And I guess I should also remind viewers that, you know, when we do this, we mostly focus on cover art, admittedly. So in our limited time, limited access, and things that look good on screen, we are mostly focused on cover art. That might possibly bias our analysis, and I apologize for that. So feel free in the chat to tell us about things that, you know, you wish that we'd looked at, or other artists that we don't have time to talk about today. But I want to look at some of Jeff Easley's art for core rulebooks.
So. Actually, before you start, so let me go back to like the tour guiding thing that was going to be like my whole, you know, gestalt, whatever you want to call it today.
Theme.
So the theme, yeah, thank you. I'm really well spoken as a tour guide, I swear. So basically, you know, the idea is that when I take people on the tour of the museum, I try to put things in context so that they understand, like, why the art looks the way it does. And generally, I say, you know, the art is telling you something about the cultural context. So you can find clues as to, you know, what was going on, you know, maybe politically or geographically or culturally or whatever, you know, like things, or maybe, you know, like big events that were happening, you know, and that can be reflected in the art. So, you know, when we look at because we're doing D&D, like the end of, you know, medieval art, you know, and why, you know, suddenly you have, you know, this switch to Renaissance art. And, you know, of course, the switch is not like, you know, instantaneous, but, you know, there's like the slow switch. You know, I talk about the Black Death and the fact that, you know, half of Europe is dead and people are questioning the authority of the church. And so, you know, they're questioning, you know, thematically what they want to look at, you know, so in a very broad term. So I was thinking that when we were looking at the art of the 90s, because I think there is a lot more diversity in style, that maybe we can try to like dig in into what was happening in the 90s, and can we actually look at the art and figure out like why, you know, all of a sudden you have something that's actually a little bit more interesting to me than the art of the 80s. Fair?
Absolutely.
There, okay.
immediately before the show, we had a little chat, and I suggested maybe don't get too dark on the show. And so within 10 minutes, we immediately went to Black Plague, Half of Europe Dead. And obviously, that doesn't connect to stuff that we've been living through for the last 2 years and all been traumatized. So good job. Good job, Wandering DMs.
No, you're welcome.
Dan and Isabel, we've done it.
Have a happy Sunday.
Usually it's me that does this. So thank you for...
For being the bad guy?
Yeah, exactly.
I am cast as the bad guy for a reason.
So, okay, so a piece from Jeff Easley. So this, we're looking at what was used for the cover of what was called the D&D Rule Cyclopedia. So it was this big hardcover compilation of like 10 years of what's called the basic D&D line. And Jeff was doing a lot of paintings here for the covers. I think this is technically called Encounter in the Marsh or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a knight on a horse facing probably what's a black dragon lurching out at him. Comments about this.
You know what I think I like a lot about what we're gonna see is the changes in the color palette.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the one thing that I really did not like about a lot of the art that we looked in the 90s, and I hate to be negative.
The 80s.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Is you know, it seemed the colors were very I don't know, very very bright and kind of garish. And here, you know, it seems a little bit, everything is a little bit more toned down and more subtle, you know, even though, you know, this is, you know, you've got this big red thing coming at you.
Uh-huh.
There's something, I don't know, there's something about it that seems a little bit more subtle, you know, and you've got, you know, the dragon that's kind of fading into the background and, you know, becoming this, you know, big kind of orb of light. Mm-hmm. In the back, and you just kind of like imagine how big this thing is going to be. To me, that's the big change, is like the color palette, you know, and
nice.
And maybe the printing process has, you know, changed. Maybe there's like more computerized printing process at the time that, you know, lets you have more subtle colors. I don't know, you know, that would be kind of like interesting to know about that.
Let me pull up now. I feel like I gotta remind myself how I pull up another piece here. So here is, I think this was Jeff Easley's cover of the Dungeon Master's Guide, and I feel it's got at least a slightly similar feel to it.
Yeah, this is like very circular.
Yeah, right. One character fighting a dragon with kind of colorful pastel, I guess.
Yeah.
Colors around the edges.
Yeah.
So I guess it was successful.
Yeah.
I guess it was a successful piece.
Yeah.
Right.
But you know, it's funny because it's not funny, haha, but when we were looking at the pieces that you had pulled, you know, when I think of D&D artwork, I guess what I remember is the stuff from the 90s. And I thought that mm-hmm. was like the typical stuff. And when we started digging into the 70s and 80s, I was like, oh, right, that is not the typical stuff. And maybe it's because that's when I actually started learning about D&D, you know, and I was seeing, you know, that stuff.
Okay.
But to me, that was kind of like, you know, the typical artwork was actually, you know, what the two pieces that you just showed us.
Okay. So, now, Ragnar's pointing out that those pieces are technically from 1989.
Yes.
But I feel that it set the tone for the 90s.
Yeah.
Right. And so second edition technically came out in 1990. And so it was what you had at the table. Mm-hmm. Those books are what you had at the table through the 90s, basically. So I feel like you had your eyeball on that stuff a lot through the 90s. Now, here's one other piece from Easily. I want to bring it up here. Okay, so among the settings in the 1990s, there was a setting called Al-Qadim, or Arabian Adventures. And so this was a setting based on the mythology of the Middle East, of Arabia, and it was themed on the 1001 Nights
mm-hmm.
Kind of thing. And so they had this kind of art with, you know, genies and ifrit and the things like that in the sands and Arabian-inspired stuff. And now, as we talk about this, we can't avoid the cultural issues nowadays. So, on the one hand, someone could point to this and say it's inclusive and it's bringing in, you know, ideas from different mythologies. And there are some people nowadays that would say that this was insensitive and it didn't involve people themselves from the Middle East who are creators, and that it's highly mythologized and doesn't use enough of the actual real world culture. So I guess we have to be careful about that. Does this style look a lot different from Jeff Easley's other pieces, or is it just more very very similar to the other stuff that he was doing?
You know, in some ways, actually, there's a lot of similarities. You see, you still have like kind of like this.
Right.
You know, he's got this circle that, you know, seems to be like, you know, like, this is how I'm going to start. I'm going to have this giant circular, you know. You know, motion going all the way around, and then everything is going to be around. It's going to be this giant thing and then this little thing that are kind of like chasing each other. So, you know, in some ways that's very similar. Right? Am I crazy?
But, I totally agree.
So let's talk about that. You know, so, you know, going back to like, you know, the stuff that I talk about, you know, with tourists that are on my tour, you know, so what's happening in the 90s? I think it's like this is the start of like actually people trying to be more inclusive, you know, on TV and, you know, in media in general, you know. And maybe it's awkward, maybe it's not completely successful, maybe it's not like, you know, but this is when the term like politically correct, you have to be politically correct, you know, starts to be coined, you know, and some people are very unhappy about that.
Right.
But, you know, I think maybe that is why we start seeing more diversity in the style of artwork. You know, people are trying to be a little bit more open to something that is not necessarily, you know, European-based/Western-based, you know, art, you know, and be, you know, look elsewhere and say, like, you know, maybe there are interesting stories and interesting artwork. And I think, you know, some of the stuff that we were talking about, you know, before the show, like some of the stuff that we're going to see definitely have influence, you know, of like Chinese art and Japanese art, you know, and things like that, that, you know, people who were creating grew up with, you know. So, yeah, that's all I got.
And I mean, so I think I agree that, you know, Easley's style there didn't change a whole lot from content item, from campaign to campaign, I guess.
Right.
And he did a lot of other stuff, and there were other artists working on the Al-Qadim Arabian setting. It's funny because, you know, they had a book that was, the very first book in the series was called Arabian Adventures. So here's now Dan's tripping over the third rail issue. So in the 80s, there was a book called, I think I can say this out loud, there's a book called Oriental Adventures, and that gets an enormous amount of flack nowadays.
Right.
Right. And then the Al-Qadim setting started with a book called Arabian Adventures, and it doesn't get anywhere near as much flack as far as criticism of that goes. So,
well, maybe you just getting it started, getting the ball rolling.
Great. If you didn't know about Arabian Adventures, yes, at some point.
Thanks, Dan.
So anyway, the hope would be that it's inclusive and that, you know, people get some of their mythology. It's not real world. Some of their fantasy reflected in the game would be the hope. And I get to learn a little bit about somebody else's mythologies.
Right.
One thing that I like from D&D, frankly. And if I want to learn more about the real world, I can start reading an actual history book once I get inspired from that. Pretty obvious callbacks to those things. Now, as soon as I said we're going to be talking about art in the 90s, our viewers immediately said we're going to be talking about Brom and Tony Dieterlizzi. So, of course, we're going to be talking about them. So, there's an artist that goes by the single name Brom. I believe his full name is Gerald Brom, but we just call him Brom. And so he was the lead artist on the campaign setting called Dark Sun. And Dark Sun is actually a fairly well-regarded setting. It's a post-apocalyptic setting, kind of like Dune, in which the theme is that the technology of the world, which is magic, has caused an environmental collapse. And the environment and life of the planet has collapsed as a result of that. And people are in this post-apocalyptic situation trying to survive and fight their way out of horrible fascist governments that have taken over as a result.
Hmm.
Total fantasy.
Never happen.
So Brom was the primary artist of Dark Sun, and I think many of us think that his work was very distinct. So let me go grab that's the Jeff Easley piece there. So I'll go get. So here's a piece that you spotted, and we usually leaf through the Art and Arcana book before we do these. So here's a piece that you came into my room and you said, this is a thing that popped out at me.
Right.
So that's a particular character named Neva by Gerald Brom. And from what it says in the write-up in Art and Arcana, he made this painting, and then that actually inspired the whole campaign world.
Right, yeah, you were saying that.
So between him and other people, that was a strong enough piece that we're going to make a whole campaign world basically just around this idiom. Why did that pop out to you?
Well, you know, so the one thing we're, and again, you know, I hate to like harp on the 80s, you know, over and over again, but when we're looking at the artwork of the 80s, you know, the way women were portrayed and women warriors were portrayed, it was kind of like this very silly, boobalicious, kind of portrayal of women, you know. And here, you know, obviously you still have a lot of sexuality, you know, in, you know, this portrayal of women, you know, like, you know, she's probably, I hope she would be like more covered than that, you know, if she were to actually go into battle, you know, and not hurt herself. But, you know, at the same time, you know, she looks like she could really crush you, you know, with just, you know, two of her fingers. So, you know, so on the one hand, you know, she's still, you know, very much sexualized, mm-hmm. You know, as a woman. But, you know, she's also like way, way, way stronger than we've seen or that, you know, that I remember seeing, you know, from the stuff previously. So, you know, I was like, well, maybe, you know, roles of women were changing. Maybe, you know, things were, you know, getting a little bit better for women in the workforce. Maybe there were more people, you know, who had a voice at the table, you know, and women had like more of a voice at the table, you know, in the early 90s, possibly. Anyway, she's very strong, you know, and I kind of like that. So even though, you know, I'm kind of like, she's still very scantily clad,
right.
You know, and that that might hurt in battle. But, you know, at the same time, she's like, you know, powerful and,
right.
You know, you can't deny the power that she
right.
has, which is kind of nice.
She's very muscular. She's very muscular, so it was a little bit, at least in the 90s, of a opening up
yeah.
body types
yeah.
that were acceptable. Now, let me go, right, I keep remembering, I gotta click this here. So here's a larger piece. So this was, again by Brom, so this was, like, this is a wraparound cover, so you're looking at front and
oh,
back.
Oh yeah, gotcha.
Cover of a single hardcover book, I believe. So, and you can see kind of the desolate, you know, sandy desert dune type world. I suppose you could defend thematically. Again, the Neva picture came first. You could defend thematically is that the characters started out as gladiatorial slaves.
Gotcha.
So they were dressed like gladiators to show off their bodies and actually increase the damage in the gladiatorial pit. So you have to start off, right? You have to start off without armor and fight your way out of the gladiatorial pits, and maybe someday you'll ever get armor.
Got it.
Was the idiom there. Now, of course, that is a nice little excuse for why everybody, male and female, are half naked.
Right.
And it's also hot.
Sure.
Right, and it's the world has overheated and it's hot everywhere, so you can't wear heavy armor. But everybody in the setting, male and female, was all like this. Now, again, the cultural sensitivity issues here are: is it okay to have a campaign setting where you start off as slaves, and where that's a major component of the campaign, the world structure, and the character's identity? Nowadays, a lot of people would probably say that you don't want to foist that on players. But that was the, at least starting off with his gladiatorial sense.
Right.
Everybody looked like that.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, in terms of like the choice of what people look like, that makes sense. Mm. I can see like that apply to men and women, and actually in that particular illustration, the woman like way in the back has more clothes on than the guy, immediately behind the main character here on the right. So, that's kind of interesting. Some of that stuff, I kind of like having a callback to, real culture and real cultural constructs, you can look at, the Roman circus and, kind of find some inspiration in that, and actually make the artwork a little bit more clever because of it, or at least, justify some of it, which I think is interesting. To me, that's interesting. Yeah. And, to kind of like dig into like why that was happening, in Roman time, and, can we play with that a little bit?
I agree, and I think many of our viewers who have posted comments in the last couple of minutes, are on the same page with that. Yeah. I constantly say, like, I literally don't know anything that I didn't ultimately learn from D&D, as you know. So every piece of, history that I dig into was in some way inspired or something I hoped would fold back into my D&D game. So for me, D&D has been the opportunity to learn about things that I otherwise wouldn't know are interesting, either about real world or mythology or literature in some way. So I'm very thankful that these things have inspired me to go out and learn more real history about like Roman times or something
Right.
Let me pick one more. Let me pick one more thing from Brom here. You wanted to talk about this, right?
Yeah, this one. I guess again, because I really like the color palette of that. Because it's so different from what we've seen before, and it feels, more subtle, more subdued. I love the composition, the little triangle that you have, the red triangle with, the figures in the back, that you can kind of see. And that almost looks like, like a Egyptian relief or something, Nice. No, that's not what I'm thinking about. It looks like the Greek vase,
There you go. Yep.
I'm like, how can I not see that? I talk about that all the time, the black figure and the red figure of the Greek vase. So you have those things in battle, in the back. It's just a really nice composition, and again, maybe the inspiration is, those Greek and Roman mythologies, I think are perfectly okay to get inspired to. But the colors remind me also of some of the watercolors that I see in the Asian wing of the Met, where we go through the Chinese traditional painting wing, where you have a lot of scroll paintings, and the colors are very subtle. And it's a lot of ink drawings and a lot of like, I don't know, some of those watercolors really remind me of some of the stuff that I see in the landscape painting and the traditional Chinese scroll paintings. Yeah.
And William in the chat is saying the same thing that I was just about to say, is that he's channeling, Brom here is channeling a lot of composition elements from Frank Frazetta, who painted a lot of Conan book covers
back in the day.
So they're not copies, but they're at least echoing the. There's a famous Frazetta painting of Conan, you know, again solo against a large number of opponents there and beating them all.
Right.
Frankly, I tend to use that Frazetta painting as a representation of D&D sweep attacks, where if I'm 8th level and the enemy's 1st level, I get 8 attacks per round. So I actually tend to use that as a representation of sweep attacks in traditional D&D, as a matter of fact. You know, it's funny, you know, it's funny over time because the original Frazetta painting, right, he's Conan's fighting men. And here they've, you know, transitioned to kind of inhuman serpent monsters. And it's kind of interesting how the inhumanity of the opponent has to evolve over time to become more and more inhuman to be acceptable.
Oh yeah, in terms of like the violence, yeah, I can see that.
And ultimately, it turns into either zombies, which is pretty much either zombies or robots. Those are always acceptable. I'm going to throw up just one last thing before we get off Braum here.
Sure.
Who I think is very interesting. Like either this or this. Look at this or this.
That one is nice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a Queen of the Underworld type thing. I might refer to this as. So again, he's got a lot of strong women in his paintings. And some sort of queen archmage casting a spell here, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Does that remind you of anything? We can just move on if you don't want to talk about that.
No, maybe.
Okay. Well, Queen of the Underworld.
Oh, because of the role I've been cast as Queen of the Underworld in a film, but it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
So, and it's
right.
I might have been fired from that. So
oh, really?
I don't know. Yeah.
Really?
Well, I haven't heard from the guy in a couple of weeks.
Okay, but so it's a little. Anyway, it's surprisingly like the outfit that.
A little too inside baseball, you know. So
all right,
anyway,
moving on.
So you know, very very nice composition again. You know, it's that's you know very very. Anyway, let's move on.
It kind of reminds me of like Hela from the last Thor movie, actually.
Yeah, very much so.
So we knew that we were going to talk about Gerald Braum, and we knew that we were going to talk about Dieter Leese, who also has a very specific and unique style. We like a lot of the D&D fans, you see a piece by Dieter Leese, you immediately know who was doing it.
Mm.
So let me go grab one of those.
Oh, yeah.
Let's start with this, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so in the Art and Arcana book, this is an artist's featured image where Dieter Leese himself picked this as one of the favorite things that he did for D&D. And I guess I should set the groundwork. So the campaign setting here was called Planescape, which is D&D in other dimensions. You can travel to hell, you can travel to heaven, you can travel to Asgard, you can travel the known planes. And it kind of opens up a whole lot of alien, foreign dimension type, Doctor Strange type travel, I suppose. So here you've got three adventurers, I guess, confronting what I think is a demon. Kind of, it's got some lizard draconic qualities to it. Why does that, you know, honestly, I wouldn't have picked that as like an outstanding piece. Why does that pop out to you and Tony Dieter Leese himself?
I mean, I love the composition is really quite beautiful, and I think to me because the ink work is not perfect, so you have like kind of a very loose sense of like, you know, the brush strokes and, you know, like especially for the smoke and the stone, you know, I don't know, it feels it feels like you see the person behind it. You know, you kind of, you know, it's like a human being created that and they weren't trying to be perfect, you know, so I really love that. And I love the fact that I thought it was a dragon. You think it's not a dragon, but, you know, maybe, you know, it's some other monster. You know, it's not the typical dragon that we've seen so far. So all the stuff that you've shown me before, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, you know, that's the dragon that, you know, I see all the time. And this is kind of like a very gargoyle-y and, you know, really kind of ugly and menacing and half human and, you know, with a big kind of soft belly and, you know, there's something kind of beautiful or repulsive at the same time, you know. And again, you know, because I kind of feel the brush strokes there. I feel like the ink work, you know, like I feel the person behind it. And I like that a lot.
Nice. I guess I'm just noticing kind of like the spotted stippling, like around the sides of the belly and stuff, legs and stuff. Like
Yeah. Nice. You know, and that's kind of echoed in some of the stones. So whatever's on his belly, it's kind of like echoed on the stone. It's just like, and echoed also on her. If you look at the I don't know if it's a cape.
Far right.
On figure. The far right, you know, it's kind of like this cape that's kind of going down. And it's almost echoed in that as well. Yep. So it's just like, is everything getting infected? You know, I mean, you know, or, you know, it's part of the same world anyway. So, you know, it's just like, you know, really nice choices. And I like the you know, the watercolory quality of the smoke and the stones, you know, to me that's just really beautiful. And again, you know, it reminds me of other types of artwork, so it's not just, you know, the very clean kind of a Renaissance painting. You know, there's like different ways to actually make artwork and different ways to use the material, and this kind of like is the first time that I feel the artist is not trying to be like completely perfect and clean, if that makes any sense.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I like about Dieterlese's art here, and I think the three characters on the right, I think, are elves. I mean, they've got pointed ears and they're, you know, kind of oddball colors. Is I like that the characters are frail, right? Again, as someone who, you know, has a concept of traditional D&D as a war game and a horror game, the characters are frail and likely to be shattered.
Mm.
And it feels like that in this piece and other Dieterlese, but they feel mortal. They feel human and actually at risk rather than some art that makes everybody, a Schwarzenegger bodybuilder that I don't actually believe will actually ever suffer injury.
Right.
So these characters look like they're actually risking something in this encounter, and I think I respect them and consider them to be like braver for it. Is kind of my take on that.
Interesting.
I will say, so Dieterlese is an interior artist, so, you know, we might be seeing slightly different styles because, you know, Dieterlese was doing more interior stuff and a lot of the other people were looking at cover stuff. I wanted to look at this because so this is like the primary NPC in the Planescape setting. So this is the Lady of Pain, who I believe is the controller of the city of Sigil, the city of doors, which has a bunch of portals to other planes and worlds, which I would not have been able to come up with if Ragnar hadn't reminded me. So thank you. So that's probably the canonical character in the setting. And her face gets iconified and used on the covers of like all the books after this. So he's very much, Dieterlese is very much setting the theme of the whole setting, like with this piece. Interesting in the same way or not as successful?
So, the stuff that you pulled up from this artist, you know, I actually really love.
Great.
And great. So not that, yeah. Not that I just want to talk about the Met. I'm not getting a commission if you go to the Met in New York. But and you've probably gone, if you've ever gone there or if you ever want to go, I'll put the artwork. It's way more interesting than us. It reminds me a lot of the Arms and Armor Gallery. Do you remember going to that? Right. And so it's this gallery in the Met that has arms and armors of around like the high Middle Ages, but from all over the world. So it's mostly like 14th, 15th century arms and armors. And, you know, and maybe some stuff a little later from all over the world. So it's not just, you know, the stuff in Europe. And this huge gallery on samurai arms and armors that is absolutely gorgeous. Like some of the garments and the helmets, and they have like very elaborate sculptures on top of their helmets are just absolutely gorgeous. And this kind of reminds me of that gallery.
Interesting.
You know, And when I was looking at that, I was, you know, and again, you know, thinking of like how I introduce artwork to some of the clients that I'm with, of like, you know, well, what was going on? You know, like, what can this tell you about, you know, the art or the artist? And I was just like, well, who are those artists? And, you know, and like, what were the influences? And I'm like, okay, so if you're doing artwork in the early 90s, so you were, you know, basically our age. So you were a child, you know, in the mid to late 60s, early 70s. And in the 80s, you kind of like came of age and became interested in something like D&D or whatever, you know, and that really influenced you. And I'm like, well, the big thing that was like really popular in the 80s, like, you know, people who were, you know, adults in the 90s and, you know, were basically just coming of age, you know, maybe they were teenagers or whatever, was anime. So, you know, it had, you know, and I kind of did a little bit of research, you know, before the show, and I'm like, okay, you know, the first anime on TV was in the 60s, but it became really, really popular in the 80s. And so I kind of see like some of the influence of anime and kind of the aesthetics of that and some of the artwork that we're looking at, you know, and in terms of like, you know, the palette and, you know, the brushstrokes and the choices that you make of like, you know, what the, you know, the armors look like and, you know, the face looks like, you know, to me that looks very, very anime like. I'm like, you know, all right, those artists, you know, were probably like 12 years old in like 1980 or something, you know, and they just like, you know, loved anime and they, you know, it's kind of like maybe always in the back of their mind or something. And I could be completely wrong, but to me, that's kind of looking like a big influence in some of those.
I think it's valuable for you to bring that up because, I mean, and you were working in video game companies.
Yeah.
In the 90s and early 2000s. And so, and at one point, even as a small team manager.
Yeah.
So you were seeing a bunch of people of that era come in with their sensibilities and what they wanted to bring to games and stuff like that.
Right. And a lot of young men.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So, you know, it was a job for the young and very male dominated. So, yeah.
And I'm someone who actually was into anime as about as little as anybody that I knew, actually. Like right. I have many friends that were much more into anime and would, you know, want me to participate more. And I didn't. So I watched, you know, a small amount of Space Battleship Yamato, which was broadcast all hacked to pieces as Star Blazers here in the U.S. And a tiny little bit of...
Brandizer.
No, Macross, whatever the top brand name is. Now I'm embarrassing myself. How little I know that. But a tiny little bit of that. And then, of course, you know, our viewer, Ash Adler, is a huge Gundam fan. And so we were talking Gundam on our Discord a while back. And at some point, I should probably watch more of that. So I wouldn't think to bring up anime as much as other people. So I think it's very useful for you to bring that up. There's one piece on that tip that this jumped out at you.
Yeah, this one really jumped at me as being anime like. So, you know, so I grew up in France, so we, you know, the translation unfortunately of the titles of the TV right. series are different, you know, but there's some that were actually shown in France and not here. So there was one actually that I used to watch when I was a kid called Candy. And my friend from Korea actually also had that. And we loved it. It was kind of like a very Sailor Moon kind of thing, you know. And this jumped at me as like, you know, like the... And it was a very silly, like, you know, this little girl and she was always falling in love, you know, with, you know, this guy and the other guy. And I don't remember, you know, that was a long time ago. I don't quite remember. But, you know, this particular drawing, like, totally like reminded me of like the male protagonist like you know like you know they would fall in love with this guy all the time so you know when I saw that that's when it occurred to me I'm like oh my god you know were all those artists watching the same stuff that I was watching when I was a little girl and little boy and we're like somehow it's all in the back of our mind of like you know the visual sensitivity of you know that particular style you know and it's just like it's always kind of like baked in and whether or not we realize it so you know I that really jumped at me for that.
That's
and
great.
Then when you showed me the one that we were looking at previously it seemed it seemed even more obvious, you know. I was just like, oh yeah, you know, I've seen that samurai, you know, armor at the Met like yesterday, you know.
That's great. I also like so there's a magic item in D&D that comes from the literature of Jack Vance called the Ioun Stone, of a stone of power that orbits your head like it's a teeny tiny little planet and your head's the sun and gives you some kind of magical power. And so now, based on that painting, I want all my, that illustration, I want all of my Ioun stones to be platonic solids now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They're basically all teeny tiny little dice. That seems on theme. I like that a lot. I see awesome. Thiago has joined us from Brazil, so thank you for joining us today.
Oh, nice.
Glad you're with
and,
us.
And yeah, if you watch Candy in Brazil and it was called something else, let me know. Or it was just France and Korea and Japan.
It's funny because before the show started, the anime thing came up, and you said, "Well, I mean, obviously, you, Dan, have seen this, and Sailor Moon." And I'm like, "No, I didn't. I don't watch Sailor Moon. That's for girls. What? It's a clear, very clear distinction. There's a very clear binary distinction between shows for. Okay, moving on. So, little joke there.
And that's how we got in trouble. We were doing fine.
So maybe we got about 10 minutes left. We would have time for one more artist. Unless there's anything else you want to see from Dieter Leese, which is...
I mean, we can look at all of them. There's just, I mean, every single one of them is just so beautiful to me, you know. And again, you know, because I like seeing, you know, like the... You know, the artist behind everything. I mean, you know that. I think I've said that before.
Point at one of these.
Let's look at one that's like more finished, maybe like this one or this one.
You know, I kind of like this one myself.
Yeah, this one is great. This one is great. You know, and it's got like it's like a really weird.
Yeah.
You know, horror Disney. You know, with like the little Disney-fied. You know, little rooftop in the back, and then it's like this like giant mouth that you have to go through. It's like, oh yeah, come to our city. I'm like, eh, not so much.
You know, it's funny you mention that. So we in the last month got renewed our account to Disney Plus.
Yes.
So maybe I should announce that. But I've been watching a lot of Marvel shows. I've been watching Boba Fett, and then okay, I hope everybody excuses us. Then I started watching the movie from 3 years ago called Jungle Cruise that's got The Rock and it's got Emily Blunt in it, I think. And I love those actors. They're so great. And I you totally know what Disney scary is like, right? It's like the scene starts, I know exactly the level that it's going to go to and then pull back, right? And you absolutely know this like acceptable level of scary. And, you know, Dieter Leese brings in a lot of humor into his stuff. So I'm assuming that this is like the gate to Sigil, the city of portals, or something like that. And he really likes beholders that are doing something goofy. So beholders are these floating eyeball monsters.
Oh yeah, no, that I love right? that actually to have like this goofy thing looking at you.
So for what it's worth, in original D&D, when I run statistical analyses, the beholder is the second most dangerous monster in the whole game as of original D&D. It's like really ferocious creature. And then here Dieter Leese is using it as like comic relief. And so here you've got a little smiley beholder
right
as a guard here. Behind the gate, and then he does other stuff like that. And this is the kind of thing that I would normally hate, I think, but I really like this piece of like the beholder who himself is actually scared, him or herself is actually frightened of something,
right?
And it's off screen, and to me, that like actually that's kind of an interesting story of like, oh my goodness, what could be so completely horrifying if the beholder is actually scared of it?
Yeah,
that's a big problem, and I don't know why. I don't know if I'm like a hypocrite, because I think that sometimes I would say like, don't infantilize your top monsters, and yet that really works for me.
Well, you know, we can have a whole show about human humor in art and whether or not, you know, it's used properly or not. But a lot of people, you know, don't want to put humor in art, you know, and I think. You know, I actually, again, in my tours, you know, I actually point out some of the stuff where you see something that's actually kind of humorous, you know, because I think it's a legitimate, legitimate emotion in art as well. So, yeah.
I think, and it can succeed and it can fail.
Sure.
Right? And you and I have been talking about this recently, is, you know, some people, you know, attempt it and it kind of falls flat. And Dieter Leese, somehow it just works.
Yeah.
For me. And I like that. And it's like all the slightly funny beholders. And I kind of like this. I don't know if this was actually published in a D&D product. The character in front seems like out of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or something.
Yeah.
But again, it's kind of like, whoops, that's a much worse situation than I expected.
Right.
Which I kind of like. Right. So, So we like Dieter Leese. Anytime I see it, it's funny because it's kind of not the style I think I would normally like. I would normally actually like something more from the 80s, actually. And yet it's successful, and I feel pleasure every time that I see it. I recognize a Dieter Leese piece, actually.
Oh, yeah. No, all the pieces that you pulled up, I thought were actually fantastic.
Yeah.
So do you want to look at somebody else?
Yeah, as usual. So I'm kind of pushing in more stuff than I probably should. So if we're going to look at one other artist, I wanted to look at Rob Ruppel is his name. So
those were great, actually.
What do you want to look at first here?
Maybe either that one or that one.
That's
that's
exactly what I was going to do. So here's Rob. I'm pretty sure this is Rob Ruppel. And he's working in the Ravenloft campaign setting. So Ravenloft is the gothic horror vampire Transylvania Halloween type campaign setting. And there was a very famous adventure, I think in 1983, called Ravenloft, that was a huge, huge, huge hit, and in some ways changed the ways that adventures were written, actually. And then I believe in 1990, they expanded it to a whole campaign setting, a whole, you know, alien dimension that was run by the vampire, whatever his name is. So here's a piece by Rob Ruppel, I think showing a vampire in a cemetery type setting with the, you know, scary moon overhead. What pops out to you about that?
So you know what pops out to me? I'm just like, why is everybody using circular you know, it's just like circles and circles and circles. Is it like the Dante's Inferno kind of thing? You know, this is like everybody has a, you know, circular composition. This is really kind of funny. It's maybe it's just the pieces that we pick. Maybe it says something more about us than the artist, but it's just like, all right, here we go, the circle going into the sun and another circle.
You know, again, these are cover pieces, I'm pretty sure, so I don't know if that's like a thing that draws the possible buyer into the product. It's successful, I think.
But you know but I the characters are different, you know, for this one. So I think the way the humanoid, because I'm, you know, if it's a vampire, he's not human anymore, right? Technically
undead is what we'd say.
You know, it's like a very different way to like show a person, I guess. You know, from what we've seen. So it's kind of nice to have a very different different portrayal of humans than we've seen so far, you know, and all the stuff that we've looked at. You know, so you know, the point of view, you know, is different, and the way he's clothed, and you know, kind of like the callback of like, you know, his, you know, whatever his color, and you know, the gargoyle, you know, it's very similar-ish, you know. So I like it that, you know, because of that, you know, it's very different from what we've seen so far.
Yeah, it's a very different perspective, and clearly it's a character that is, you know, a villainous instead of heroic. So they have him in a light that is traditionally kind of threatening, you know, kind of looking down at you. I see in the chat, Joshua was reminding me the character's name is Strahd, a little echo of like Vlad, you know, kind of thing. So
the character's name is Strahd.
And Thiago is reminding us that Rob Ruppel here did work for the game Werewolf the Apocalypse. So he does a lot of horror type stuff.
A lot of
like
horror
this.
Type stuff, yeah. There were a couple of other stuff that you pulled out from that artist that were really nice at me.
We both liked this. I got to admit, that's very successful.
Yeah.
So you have some zombies or ghouls here, again, for, above the camera angle,
right,
looking down at the viewer. That feels legitimately scary to me.
Yeah, I mean, because I think you're not used to having zombies actually looking directly at you.
Right.
You know, they're always like this witless thing that are kind of like chasing you around.
Yes.
But this is like, you know, they're plotting against you. Those people are like, they're talking to each other and they're plotting against us, you know, and this is really, it is very scary.
And it's a lot more detail. Like normally you see zombies as like a mob, like in D&D, that you can have zombies in a big mob, right? At a little bit of a distance. Okay. It's a big undifferentiated mob.
Right.
And here there's a lot of detail here about the hair on the one on the right. The one on the left, I think, I just noticed a second, is actually wearing glasses, right? Am I crazy about that?
No, I think... I misread that.
So they all have very distinct personalities.
Yeah.
Right? They have very different facial structures, different like states of decomposition and very different personalities. And somehow that feels worse.
That
I might have to deal with a whole... It feels like I have to deal with a whole bunch of stuff instead of just, like, mob of zombies.
Right, exactly.
So, I think it might have been Shannon Appleklein who pointed this and said, well, the horror in Ravenloft is very Disney. It doesn't get too bad.
Mm.
There wasn't, like, a huge cultural uproar about this, the same way there was about D&D itself in the 80s for some weird reason.
Huh.
Right? So all D&D in the 80s had this huge cultural, you know, eruption of how dare you talk about magic to, you know, teenagers or tweens.
But zombies were okay.
Who knows? Maybe it wasn't as popular, right? Maybe it wasn't. It didn't get enough mind share to bother people.
Mm.
Maybe the explosion of different campaign settings was enough chafe that nobody was going to pick specifically just on this one product as being a problem.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's not entirely clear. Anything else there by Ruppel?
Let's see. No, is that the last one? We could look at this one, I guess. Let's see, what is that? Oh, this is nice too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, and again, you know, it feels like there's more intelligence in the zombies than what we used to.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're definitely kind of plotting against you and, you know, kind of very specifically looking at something.
Right.
They're not, you know, just like mindlessly, you know, going for brains.
Right.
It's just like they're actually doing, you know, some plotting together.
Right. You can see that, like in this campaign, so like gothic horror, right? It slightly moved the time frame up a little bit, so you could have stuff that's potentially, you know, from the Poe era of technology, right? So you have a steamship here.
Right.
You wouldn't normally see in D&D. You probably have printing presses.
It's
why I kind of like incorrectly guessed that there was one wearing glasses that would have possibly been on the table in this campaign setting. So here these zombies or whatever are... Like, it's weird because I thought, like, when I first saw this, I thought the ship was sailing away. But now I'm thinking that they're fraudulently signaling it, that it's safe to come in and dock.
That's how I'm reading that, that they're, you know, they're going, they're on the dock going, hey, yeah, no, everything's fine.
Right.
And this guy's like, yeah, just hold them like this.
You know, it's funny. I am slow. I tend to be slow at reading stuff. So you picked up on that. Ragnar picked up on that. It's taken me a day to decode this. And I, you know, frankly, in my improv class on Friday, that was the thing I was frustrated with. It was decoding physical activities. That's a whole different story. We all agree that Dan's the slowest person at picking up on obvious physical activities.
No, but sometimes you can look at a piece of artwork and you just go too quickly, you know, don't notice actually some of the details that, you know, give you some of the clues that you need.
Yeah.
So,
So we are going over time as usual.
As usual.
So do you have any final thoughts on D&D art in the 90s? What's your overall takeaway from, and you know, there's many more artists that we didn't have time for.
True.
But our viewers knew, you're going to talk about art in the 90s, you're going to talk about Brahm, you're going to talk about Dieter Leese. I like both of them. I think they're standout artists.
Yeah.
What is your takeaway from the art of the 90s that we saw?
Well, you know, I think it's getting to, you know, more something that, you know, speaks to me a little bit more. And I'm, you know, I was trying to figure out why that was. I'm like, is that because I was young in the 90s and that was when I was introduced to, you know, the art of D&D, or just like some of the people that I used to work with and, you know, that was kind of like the style that they were going for, you know, when I was working at Turbine, you know, back in the days. So I don't know. I don't know why it speaks to me better. And I think there is more diversity in terms of like style, I think, that, you know, and actually, you know, maybe the 70s, there were some stuff there that I really liked. So I think the 80s for me are like kind of like this, blech, you know, and then, you know, the 90s start to become a little bit more interesting again. But, you know, maybe it's just me, you know.
I think this is how you got disinvited the first time.
I think so.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting perspective that you said that your initial image of like what D&D art is like, your initial instinct was it's the stuff from the 90s.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't realize that, you know, until I saw it today. Yeah. I was just like, oh, yeah, right. That's, you know, that's my association with it. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting.
And to me, honestly, it's more from the 80s.
Well, that's
To me, right.
We're done.
Yeah. This is why we this is why we do this once a year.
That's it.
But I really do like these. These are not products that I played with. I didn't game in any of these worlds, and I didn't own any of these products.
Gotcha.
So I didn't game with Dark Sun. I didn't play with Planescape or Spelljammer or Ravenloft or any of these things. But when these particular pieces pop up, I enjoy them very much. Right. You know, the funny thing is, the only thing I ever did with Dark Sun is that when you and I both worked for what became Papyrus Racing, right? We had to put NASCAR Racing on the 10 network.
So
at the same time that we were putting NASCAR there, they also had Dark Sun Online. They had an early, massively multiplayer D&D game called Dark Sun Online.
Oh, wow. So I've never heard of that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So for a little while, I would be working on getting NASCAR running on 10.
And then you were playing
and
on
then,
the...
Right. And then since I had the free account, I would actually go play Dark Sun Online on the 10 network after hours. Yeah. That's the entirety of what I know about Dark Sun, actually. So you read that.
I guess it's a wrap, right? Mm-hmm. It's a wrap on the 90s artwork. And if you have any thoughts or would like to leave a comment, you can use the comments page.
Yeah, we would very much like to see that. Yeah. So continue the conversation in the comments. And of course, if you're new to the show, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. It's normally me and Paul, by the way. But when it gets to be me and Isabel, that's a special treat that we all enjoy. So if you'd like to like, follow, subscribe to us, we are on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch and Facebook and GitHub. And also TikTok, even though there's nothing there yet. And we have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. So look for us there and you'll get updates on future shows.
And you can also get audio versions of the show on all the top podcast providers and also on our website, or your website, mm-hmm. I should say, WanderingDMs.com.
Right. And if you see us there and like or upvote there, we really appreciate it, of course. Huge thanks to all of our patrons who support the show. Just move this over here. And if you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And you'll see our different tiers. We have discounts on merch, access to our private Discord server, monthly behind-the-scenes stuff. We have after-party chat. Paul is out wandering this week. So I don't think he'll be part of that. But I will be hosting the after-party chat today in about 10 minutes on our Discord server. So if you'd like to be part of that continuing conversation, we got a $1 level. Just pop a dollar in there and you'll get on the Discord server and we'll enjoy seeing you. Upcoming shows this week. I will be back Tuesday night for more Dan Plays Games from the Elder Times.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah.
that we were working on a new trailer for this week.
That's right. Actually. That's right.
They were pretty happy about.
In my new role as a producer.
Right, exactly. super valuable. So I'll be playing the 1993. Speaking of the 90s, huh? The old Hook It Up.
I get you.
I'll be playing more of the 1993 game Dungeon Hack, which is a horribly brutal solo mega dungeon crawl that I have never won. So I'm beating my head against that. And my character is currently permanently cursed. And also I got level drained. So I'm going to keep trying to bang my head against that with the viewer's help. So hopefully that goes well. I believe TDR is currently off on Thursdays, I think. I think that's a plan. We'll probably sync up on that. But if you tune in next week, we are scheduled to have a very special guest next week, Mr. Spencer Crittenden, who is the, you may possibly know, is the Dungeon Master from the Harmon Quest TV show.
Nice.
Produced by Dan Harmon. And he also has a podcast called the That Happens podcast, which is, again, D&D themed, and he also is currently producing D&D stuff on YouTube.
Excellent.
So Paul and I will be very, when Paul's back next week, we'll be very interested in speaking, getting some questions to Spencer Crittenden about what it's like to be a big-time TV DM.
Excellent.
So we hope that you'll join us in next week for that. Now, Isabel, your time is so very valuable. I enjoy having you here. The viewers enjoy having you here. Steven's already asking, when do we get to talk about the art of the 2000s? So probably in season 5, probably, I'm guessing.
Well, we'll see. You know, so this summer I'm taking a 6-week intensive acting program. So actually I'm going to have more time because I'm not going to have time to actually do tour guiding or background work.
All right.
So I may, you know, maybe over the summer.
Okay.
You know, maybe...
Maybe we'll have a maybe we'll have a short season of something as when you blow off steam from your acting intensive class. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, apparently I have to take a clowning class, so I don't know.
Did that cause a huge argument last night over the clowning class?
Absolutely.
A little bit. I mean, it's not like we disagree about it.
No, of course not.
I mean, it's gonna be there, of course. Great. we will look forward. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
Look forward to that. So don't forget, of course, we, the Wandering DMs, are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for Mr. Spencer Crittenden and another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then, or they will see you then.